a piece of limestone with the name Peg written on it. None of the painted glass figurines or charming landscapes dotted with sheep and cheerful women that Mum liked. Stuff, but not clutter. The room smells piercingly and wonderfully of whatever is cooking on the stove. "They'll have your room," Peg says to Beach as soon as he comes in. In the light, I can see that Beach has grown into a great, ruddy creature who clearly takes after his father. He looks a little like he's made of wood, and because wood is fairly inflexible, it takes him a while to change his expression. When he does, it's not pleased.
"They never will," Beach replies.
"And where, then, would you like them to stay?" Peg Grattan asks. It's strange to see her in this context. Not in the butcher's as someone who will cut your heart out. Not in our yard, telling me not to race. Not in a headdress cutting my finger with a knife. She is smaller somehow, neater, though her ginger curls are still unruly as ever. I'm bewildered at how easily she and Beach and Gabe go around and around about where we'll sleep. And I realize that some of the time that Gabe was gone must have been spent here. Maybe a lot of it. It makes me realize we've come here because this is where Gabe feels safe. It makes me feel strange and sad, like we've been replaced with another family. "Where's Finn?" I break in.
"Washing his hands, of course," Gabe says. "It may be decades."
I feel weird about that too. The rather free admittance of Finn's foibles, though I've always thought it was something private. Something only Connolly's knew about. Gabe didn't say it like he was making fun of Finn. But it feels like it. "Where is the toilet?" Tommy, not Peg or Beach, gestures toward the stairs on the other side of the kitchen. It's like it's everyone's house, not just the Grattans. Feeling sulky, I head out of the room. There's a tiny, dark hallway with three doors off it, up at the top of the stairs, but only one of them has light coming from underneath it. I knock. There's no response until I say Finn's name, and then, after a pause, the door opens. It's a tiny room, just big enough for a tub and a toilet and a wash basin if they're very good friends and don't mind rubbing shoulders. And Finn sits on the toilet with the lid down. There are big, manly footprints on the small tiles of the floor. I shut the door behind me and check to make certain that the tub is dry before stepping into it and sitting down. "He comes here all the time," Finn says to me.
"I know," I reply.
"I can tell. This is where he's been." The betrayal sits thick between us. I want to say something to make this better for Finn, who idolizes Gabe, who would do anything for him. But I can't think of anything.
"Do you think Puffin's dead?" Finn asks.
"No. She got away," I say. He studies his hands. They're a little chapped on the knuckles from all the washing he's been up to.
"Yes, I thought so too."
I look away, to the shiny handles of the bathtub. So shiny that they remind me of the grill of Father Mooneyham's car. "So," I say, "one day..." Finn nods solemnly.
"One day. The worst will be early tomorrow morning, I think."
"Sure, of course. How do you know?" He looks impatient.
"Everything. If people use their eyeballs, everybody would know."
The door swings open then, without a knock, and Gabe stands in the doorway. He looks in better humour than I've seen him for a long time.
"Is it a party you're having in here?"
"Yes," I say. "It started in the tub, and then it spread to the loo. All that's left is a sink if you want it."
"Well, everyone's wondering where you are. There's lamb stew in the works, but only if you come out of the toilet."
Finn and I exchange a glance. I wonder if he's thinking what I'm thinking. That Gabe can't just pretend that there's no bad feeling, that he hasn't been gone, that things will just go back the way they were. I thought before that a word from him would be enough, but now I know that I want him to court my good graces. If I can't have a grovelling apology,
I don't want anything at all. As we head down the stairs, Gabe says,
You have the couch, I'm afraid, Finn, because you're the shortest.
Under whose measure?
I say. Gabe shrugs.
Well, you're the shortest, technically. But Peg thinks you should be in a room with a door. So we're in Beach's room.
Where is Beach, then?
He and Tommy are on a mattress in the living room. Peg says it'll work this way.
Back in the kitchen, the boys are loud and talking over each other. Beach and Tommy have a hold of something and are trying to keep it out of each other's reach. And a sheepdog's appeared from nowhere and is trying to get it as well. Peg holds a spoon in one hand and a cat by its scruff in the other. She's swearing at both of them.
Put that out, she says to Gabe,
and he takes the cat from her and puts it on the other side of the door. She scowls at me.
I don't cook. Cats make it worse.
Before I have a chance to answer, Gabe asks,
Where's Tom?
It takes me a moment to realize that he means Thomas Grattan. I'd never considered that Thomas Grattan became Tom under his own roof. He went out to see if the Mackies were doing all right.
Beach, get out! All of you, out! Go into the living room while I get this done. Out!
Beach and Tommy obey and take their noise with them. And Finn files after them, interested because of the appearance of the dog. I turn to go, but in the doorway, I hesitate and look back over my shoulder. Peg Grattan has turned back to the great black range to stir the pot, and Gabe stands just behind her, saying something into her ear. I just catch him saying,
Strong enough.
And,
Puck! Catch it!
Tommy shouts. I turn my face toward the living room in time to catch a sock full of beans in the mouth. Beach guffaws, but Tommy looks aggrieved and apologizes. The collie is now frolicking around my feet with great friendliness, very eager to have the sock, and I realize that this is what Beach and Tommy were fooling around with earlier.
You should be sorry,
I say sternly to Tommy, who still looks beaten, standing on the other side of the worn green couch that will be Finn's bed. And then I hurl the sock back to him. Pleased to be so easily forgiven, he grins and whips it without pause to Beach, who loses it to the dog. Tommy has no qualms about making a fool of himself, scrabbling after the collie as she leads him on a merry chase, and even Finn's laughing. I find myself wondering what drives Tommy to leave the island. He doesn't have the brooding of Gabe or the sulkiness of Beach. I've never seen him when he doesn't seem perfectly content, perfectly a part of island life. On the floor, Tommy snags a sock, finally. And around it goes to all of us, even the dog again, until Finn says,
Where's Gabe?
And we realize that he hasn't come out of the kitchen. I start toward the kitchen, but Tommy takes my arm.
I'll go.
He peers around the doorframe, and I can't hear what he says. Then he turns back to us, and he has a smile pinned on for us.
Good news! Food's done!
Gabe appears in the doorway beside him, and they exchange a look that infuriates me, because it's yet more of the secret language of men. Finally, Peg appears and addresses all of us.
If you want it, you have to serve yourself. And if you don't like it, blame Tom. He did it.
There's not much conversation as we eat. Maybe, like me, they're all reimagining the events of the evening. But it's a quiet without demands. The storm's not loud enough to make itself known, and it's easy to pretend that we're just over for a social visit. The only time Peg Grattan addresses me is to tell me that I'm welcome to give Dove more hay if she needs it before the end of the night, before the storm gets bad. And she's right about the storm. By the time we go to bed, the wind has become fitful and furious, shaking the window panes. The sheets on the bed are clean, but the room still smells like Beach, who smells like salt ham. Before we turn off the lights, I see that there are no personal effects in the room. Nothing to say that it is Beach's. Just this bed, and an austere desk with an empty vase and some coins on it.
and a narrow dresser with well-worn corners.
I wonder if there used to be more of Beach here, but he packed it all away to take with him to the mainland. I consider this as I try to sleep. I lie on one side of the bed, and Gabe lies on the other. But it's a twin bed, so the two sides are really one side, and his elbow is kind of in my ribs, and his shoulder is mashed against mine. It's warmer here, too, than at our house, and having Gabe here makes it warmer still. So I'm not sure how I'll sleep. Gabe's breathing doesn't sound like he's sleeping, either. For a long moment, we lie there in the dark, listening to the rain on the roof, and I think about the broken fence back home and the last sound I heard out of Puffin, and that long, long black face, looking into the lean-to. Because I'm tired, I say exactly what I'm thinking, without a lick of tact to make it go down easier.
Why did you come back for us?
Even though I'm whispering, my voice is loud in the little bedroom. Gabe's reply from the other side of the bed is withering. Honestly, Puck, why do you think?
What does it matter to you?
Now he's indignant. What kind of a question is that?
Why are you answering all of my questions with other questions?
Gabe tries to shift to put space between us, but there's no more mattress for him to move to. The bed groans and creaks like a ship at sea. Only the sea is the bare floor of Beach's ham-scented room.
I don't understand what you want me to say.
I don't want to be accused of being hysterical, so I measure my words out, careful and slow.
I want to know why you care about us now, when next year you'll be gone, and we could both be eaten in October, and you'll be off on the mainland and never know.
In the dark, I hear Gabe sigh heavily.
It's not like I want to leave you two behind.
I hate myself for the little flutter of hope that I feel when he says it. But it's true that I imagine him, with his arms flung wide, announcing that he's changed his mind, as he embraces Finn, and Dove, and me at once. I say,
then don't. Just stay.
I can't.
Why not?
I just can't.
It's the most we've spoken in a week, and I wonder if I should just let it go at that. I imagine him leaping up, throwing the bedclothes from himself, and bolting from the room to avoid further questioning. Only, if he wanted to escape, he'd have to cross the bodies of Tommy Falk and Beach Grattan on the mattress on the floor, and avoid falling over the couch with Finn on it, and then sit by himself in the dark kitchen. And I don't think he'll do that. So I say,
that's not a real reason.
For long moments, Gabe doesn't answer, and I just hear him breathing, in and out, in and out. Then he says, in a strange, thin voice, I can't bear it anymore. I'm so strangely grateful for this honesty that I don't know what to think. I struggle to think of a good question, a question that will keep him talking like this. It's like the truth is a bird that I'm worried of frightening away. What can't you bear?
This island, Gabe says.
He breathes, a long pause between every word he says.
That house you and Finn are in. People talking. The fish. Goddamn fish. I'll smell like them for the rest of my life. The horses, everything. I can't do it anymore.
He sounds miserable, but he didn't look miserable earlier, when we were all in the kitchen, when we were perched, all over the sitting room eating. I don't know what to tell him. Everything that he said are things that I love about the island, except for maybe the smell of fish, which I guess might ruin everything else. But I don't know if that's a good enough reason to leave everything behind and start over. It feels like he's confessed that he's dying of a disease I've never heard of, with symptoms I can't see. The utter wrongness of it, the way it won't fit in my head,
keeps coming back to me again and again, as if I've only just learned about it. The only concept I can truly understand is that this thing, this strange and incomprehensible and invisible thing, is big enough and strong enough to drive my brother from Thisbe. As much of a pull Finn and I might have on him, this has more.
Puck, Gabe says,
and I start, because his voice sounds like Finn's for some reason. Yes?
I'd like to go to sleep now.
But he doesn't. He turns onto his side, and his breathing stays light and watchful. I'm not sure how long he stays awake, but I know that I fall asleep before he does.
Chapter 39 Sean. In the early, black morning, the storm wakes me. The wind roars overhead, an engine, the surf, the howl of a sea creature. My eyes adjust to the darkness, and I see lights moving outside. Rain bursts across the glass in waves, furious and then more furious. Now I hear the horses. They whinny and call and thump the walls. The storm has whipped them to a frenzy, and outside something is screaming. It's this scream that's woken me, not the wind. I sit up to act without considering, and after I do, I hesitate. Those are my horses down there in this beleaguered stable, out there in that fearful night. But at the same time, they are not mine too, and I've quit, making them even less mine than they were before. I should stay here, doing nothing, letting the night do what it will. Let Malvern survey the havoc in the morning light and decide that I'm invaluable. I close my eyes, my forehead on my fist, and listen to the wail outside. Even closer, downstairs, I hear a terrified horse kicking its stall wall, smashing either the wall or itself to destruction. You overestimate your importance to this yard, Mr. Kendrick. But I haven't. I can't let a single horse die because I am playing games with Malvern. I shove on my boots and snatch my jacket, and as I reach for the knob of my door, there's a knock on the wood. It's Daly. His hair is plastered wet over his face, and there's blood on his shirt sleeves. He shivers helplessly.
Malvern says to do it without you, but we can't. He doesn't have to know, please.
I lift my jacket to show him I was already coming, and together we jog down the narrow dark stairs to the stable. Everything smells of rain and the ocean and yet again more rain. Daly hurries alongside me.
They won't calm down. There's a Kapalishka somewhere outside, and we don't know if he's among the horses or... We don't know who's hurt, because that sound, you can hear it. They're all kicking themselves lame. You get one calm, and the others drive it crazy again.
They won't be calm with that scream going on, I say. Every groom and stable boy and rider that Malvern has is in evidence, trying to calm the most precious of the horses. The bulbs overhead sway in wind that's found its way inside, and the swinging light stripes over me and away, like I'm losing consciousness. I pass Metal in her stall. She keeps rearing and clawing her front hooves against the wall as she comes back down. If she's not unsound now, she'll be soon. I hear Cor clucking and singing, driving the horses near him to madness. Somewhere behind me, another horse is slamming a hoof against a wall, rhythmic and senseless. Outside, the screaming continues. Daly trails me as I go to Cor's stall. In my pocket, my hand closes around a stone with a hole through it. If Cor were any other water horse, I'd string it onto his halter tonight to make more noise in his head than the approaching November sea does. But Cor is not any other water horse, and my tricks will only make him more anxious. I open my hand and leave the stone in my pocket.
Keep everyone clear, I snap. Keep them out of my way.
I push open Cor's door and he charges toward the aisle. I press my hand into his chest and then slap it, shoving him back. One of the thoroughbreds whinnies piercingly.
Keep them clear,
I remind Daly. He bolts ahead of me to pass this along, and then I let Cor plunge out of his stall and tug me down the aisle toward the door to the yard. It's closed against the rain and worse. Not out there, Daly protests from behind me. Malvern's out there. That's too bad. So Malvern will know that I'm still among his horses. But I can't stop any of what is going on in here without fixing the problem out there first. I push through the door, core strong and difficult on the other end of my lead line. I'm instantly wet to the skin. There's water in my ears, my eyes. I'm drinking the sky. I have to swipe the water from my forehead and blink to clear my vision. Shingles from the stable are scattered all across the yard. Every light in the yard is on, and there are waterlogged halos around each of them. Three mares stand at the gate, pressing, desperate to get in. They're broodmares from some of Malvern's far-flung pastures on the way to Hastaway. The fact that they're free means that something bad has happened to their fencing, and they came seeking the familiar. One of them limps so badly that my heart sinks. The largest of the mares must recognize something in my walk, because she stops struggling and whinnies to me, long and entreating, trusting me to rescue her from whatever made her come here. And there's Malvern and David Prince, the head groom. Malvern holds a shotgun. It's an optimistic thought on his part. Out here, the scream sounds like it's coming from all around us. It vibrates in every raindrop, throbs in the clouds overhead. It's a howl like venom, a paralyzing promise. This storm has driven the island mad. Cor jerks and hauls at my arm. I see his hooves leave the cobbles and return, but I can't hear the sound of them. I can only hear the throbbing scream, loud as if it's in my head. It's meant to travel miles underwater. I yank Cor's halter to catch his attention, and then I haul his head down next to mine. His lips are pulled back in a ghastly grin. It's not a Cor I like seeing. My pulse races despite every year we've spent together. He's a monster. With one hand, I press those teeth away from me, and with the other, I turn his ear toward me. Pursing my lips, I keen into his ear. It's lower than the scream that we hear now, the scream that's getting closer. Cor is distracted. His lips are pulled far, far back from his teeth. He is no horse. I twist his ear hard enough to hurt, and again, I hum into his ear, a low hum that dips to a groan at the end. Malvern lifts his shotgun, looking at something I can't see in the dark and the mist. Cor! I shout. Rain creeps into my mouth when I do, and I keen again to him. Malvern fires, but the scream from the approaching Capel Ishka is unbroken. It cannot get any louder. And then, finally, Cor begins to keen as I prompt him. Low, groaning. So that I feel it in the lead rope I hold. So I feel it in the soles of my shoes. So it bubbles beneath the scream. Cor's keen grows and widens to a groan. A growl. A roar like the wind against the buildings. The sound fills the yard and rolls out through the rain. It's a territorial battle cry. A threat. A statement. This land is already mine. This is my herd. The other scream diminishes in the wake of Cor's howl, which ascends to fill the space that's left behind. The mares at the gate go wild with fear, and I know the horses in the stable are worse for it. Cor's pure, high scream is no different from the scream it replaced, except this one I can stop. I listen and listen to be sure that Cor's cry is the only one. One of my eardrums, the one closest to Cor, merely hisses. But my left ear hears no other contender. Now I hold Cor's halter in a tight fist and press my fingers against his veins, tracing counterclockwise. Cor's scream falters. I press my lips to his shoulder and whisper to his rain-soaked skin. The night falls silent. My right ear still hums, a radio tuned to an empty frequency. Malvern and Prince look at me. The brood mares at the gate shiver and huddle together. Inside the stable, the kicking has died down. The rain streams down, There's not a single dry thing left in the world. Across the yard, Malvern gestures shortly to me. I lead Cor into the hazy light that Malvern stands in. Malvern's eyes flick from me to Cor, who's black in the wet and the night. "Have you changed your mind yet?" Malvern asks me. "No." Malvern's tone is dismissive. "I haven't either. This changes nothing." I'm not sure I believe him.
Chapter 40. Puck. As Finn predicted, the storm pounds Thisbe for a night and a day, and by the end of that rainy day, we're able to retreat back to our house. I'm relieved, because I'd rather run barefoot in the Scorpio races than try to sleep in Beach's narrow ham-scented bed with Gabe again. Tommy's eager to return home because he left his Kapil Ishka in the care of his family across the island, and he's not certain how well they're doing. I think that I'd like to meet Tommy's family, if they are the sort who wouldn't mind having a water horse left in their care while Tommy ventures out to save the neighbours. It's not exactly like asking your mother to put out a tin of chopped meat for your cat while you're gone. I know I must have met Tommy's parents at some point. I must have met everyone on Thisbe at some point. But I cannot accurately place them in my head. In my imagination, Mr. and Mrs. Falk both have Tommy's brilliant blue eyes and his lovely lips. I also grant him some siblings while I'm at it. 2 brothers and a sister. The sister is homely. The brothers are not. By evening, we are ready to strike out. The boys are so manly that they have to ride in Tommy's car again, but I make a hasty bridle by looping Dove's lead line back through her halter, creating reins so that I can ride her bareback after them. The door to the house slams, and a moment later, I realize Peg Grattan has come out to stand by me. Her arms crossed, she watches silently as I carry off Dove's shoulders. "Thank you again," I say finally, because I need to say something. She doesn't reply, just lifts her eyebrows like a nod without the head movement. "There's still a lot of people who don't want you on that beach." I try not to feel angry at her. "I told you, I wasn't going to be talked out of it." Peg laughs then, a sound like a crow cawing. "I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about men who don't want a girl in their race." My mouth says, "Oh," but my voice doesn't. "You just watch yourself. Don't let anyone tighten your girth for you. Don't let anyone else feed your mare." I nod, but I'm thinking that it's easy to imagine someone being annoyed by me riding, but harder to imagine someone being willing to do anything nefarious about it. I ask, "What about Sean Kendrick?" I look at Peg Grattan, and she is smiling a small, secret smile at me, as masked as she was beneath the bird headdress. "You sure don't like to do anything the easy way, do you?"
"I didn't know," I start truthfully, "that it was the hard way when I started on it."
Peg plucks a piece of straw out of Dove's mane. "It's easy to convince men to love you, Puck. All you have to do is be a mountain they have to climb, or a poem they don't understand. Something that makes them feel strong or clever. It's why they love the ocean." I'm not sure that is why Sean Kendrick loves the ocean. Peg continues, "When you're too much like them, the mystery's gone. No point seeking the grail if it looks like your teacup." I'm not trying to be sought.
She purses her lips. "All I'm saying is that you're asking them to treat you like a man, and I'm not sure either of you want that."
There's something discomforting about what she says, though I'm not sure if it's because I disagree or agree with it. I think of Ake Paulson backing his horse away from me, and the combination of her words and the memory sit uneasily in my chest.
"I just want to be left alone," I say.
"Like I said," Peg replies, "you're asking to be treated like a man." She makes a step out of her fingers, laced together to help me up. Then she pats Dove's rump so that Dove will move to follow Tommy's car as it leaves.
I turn around as we go. Peg's still standing there watching us, but she doesn't wave. My spirits slowly lift as we put distance between us and the Grattan's white house. After so much time cooped up, the air feels clean and well-washed. The island itself looks like our kitchen. Too much stuff, not enough tidying. There's bits of wooden fence thrown far away from fence lines, shingles and roof tiles resting in hedgerows, branches from faraway trees abandoned in the middle of fields. Sheep wander freely across the road, which isn't so unusual, but I spot some glossy mares grazing outside of their fence as well. The watery evening light is like a cautious smile through tears. There's no sign of the Capel Ishka that came up out of the storm, and I wonder if they've all climbed back into the sea again. For the moment, the island seems so utterly peaceful, unmarked by trouble and horses and weather. I think we'd have entirely different tourists if this were the face Thisbe wore all the time. Only I know this isn't the real Thisbe. The real Thisbe starts again at sunup tomorrow. Just a little over a week to go until the races. I don't think I'm ready. It's hard to imagine that our story will end the way I told Finn. Good luck doesn't seem to be something that holds the hands of the Connollys these days. But when I get home, Finn's face is shining and joyful. Behind him, in the kitchen, is Puffin the barn cat. Her tail is bitten off and ugly, and she's very indignant and sorry for herself. But she's also very alive. The island is a cunning and secretive thing. I can't say what it has planned for me.
Chapter 41. Sean. That evening, as the last light is fading, I do as my father used to, and strike off across the fields to the beach that faces west. As the sun shines low and red across the water, I wade into the ocean. The water is still high and brown and murky with the memory of the storm, so if there's something below it, I won't know it. But that's part of this, the not knowing. The surrender to the possibilities beneath the surface. It wasn't the ocean that killed my father in the end. The water is so cold that my feet go numb almost at once. I stretch my arms out to either side of me and close my eyes. I listen to the sound of water hitting water. The raucous cries of the terns and the guillemots in the rocks of the shore. The piercing, hoarse questions of the gulls above me. I smell seaweed and fish, and the dusky scent of the nesting birds on shore. Salt coats my lips, crusts my eyelashes. I feel the cold press against my body. The sand shifts and sucks out from under my feet in the tide. I'm perfectly still. The sun is red behind my eyelids. The ocean will not shift me and the cold will not take me. Everything about me is exactly the same as it was 500 years ago, when Thisbe priests would stand in the frigid, dark sea and give themselves over to the island. I try to make the inside of me as still as the outside. I have no more care than one of the gulls circling above me, thinking only of how to survive this moment and then the next. I whisper to the sea three times. Once I ask that Kor will be meek and good, so they'll have no reason to use the bells and magic that he so despises. But twice I whisper for him to be despicable, so that they'll beg for me to come back.
Chapter 42. Puck. The island's mad. Because I rode Dove back from Hastaway the evening before, I give her the morning off, and tell her to eat some expensive hay. I give her a bit of the grain, too. Not too much, because she'll just get ill on it, and leave her behind to go watch the training and take notes. I don't have any more November cakes, and we weren't home to bake anything, so I have to settle for a pocketful of stale biscuits. It doesn't take me long to realize that Thisbe has completely changed now that the festival is done and the storm has passed. Aside from the stray shingles and branches, it looks as if
The wind brought people and tents. The road from Skarmouth, clear onto the cliffs, is lined with tents and tables of every sort. Where I'd helped Dory Maud set up her booth is now a city of booths, all populated by locals trying to seduce tourists with their stuff. Some of them are the vendors who Brian Carroll and I saw while making our way through the festival. But some of them are new. The booth selling riders' colours, the hasty and incredibly tacky paintings of the race favourites, the mats to sit on to watch the race from the cliffs without getting your backside wet. I feel, suddenly and alarmingly, like the races are very close. All at once I realise that it's only days before I will walk Dove down to the beach, and I feel completely unprepared. I don't know anything about this. Nothing at all. I'm resurrected from my funk by Joseph Beringer, who dances around behind me, singing some poorly rhymed and slightly dirty song about my odds and my skirts. I don't even wear skirts, I snap at him. Especially, he says, in my daydreams. I had thought, for some reason, that being one of the riders in the Scorpio races would get me a bit more respect. But it's ever surprising, the things that don't change. I ignore him, which helps a little, if only because it feels familiar, and thread through the people toward Dory Maud's booth, avoiding Puddles and Joseph as best as I can. I can hear the commotion from the beach already, even among all the people poking in the booths. There's something about the sound that seems unlike the normal noise of the training, and I'm not sure if it's just because everyone is down on the beach at once, as the races draw close. Park! Dory Maud spots me before I spot her. She is festively dressed in a traditional scarf and rubber boots, a combination that is at once ridiculous and, unfortunately, extremely representative of Thisbe. Park! She says again, this time shaking a string of November bells at me, an action that attracts the attention of at least two others near me. She carefully lays the bells down on the table in front of her so that the price tag is showing. Hi, I say. There's a great shout from the direction of the beach, which I find oddly unsettling. Where's your horse? Dory Maud asks. Or do you mean to practice out there without her? I rode her back from Hastaway yesterday evening. She's taking a break, and I'm going to watch from the cliffs. Dory Maud eyes me. It's strategy, I add, crossly. I'm devising strategy. Not all of racing is riding, you know. I know nothing about it, Dory replies, except that Ian Privet's horse likes to come on strong from the outside at the very end, if it's anything like the last year he rode him. I remember what Elizabeth said before about Dory Maud gambling on the horses. Mum once told Dad that vices were only vices when looked at through the frame of society. I see a possible ally in Dory's vice. What else do you know? Dory Maud reaches up to better secure a bit of the flapping canvas tent, and then she says, I know that I'll tell you more if you come back after and mind the booth for an hour while I go get lunch. I regard her darkly. Again, it's not something I thought I'd have to do as a rider in the races. I'll think about it. What's that commotion anyway, do you know? Dory Maud looks enviously down at the road to the beach. Oh, it's Sean Kendrick. Interest prickles in me. What about Sean Kendrick? They're taking his red stallion down there. Mutt Mulvin and some of the other boys. With Sean? Dory Maud looks wistful then that she's trapped in the booth instead of down seeing the action. I didn't see him. Talk's going around that he won't be in the races, that he and Benjamin Mulvin fought over the stallion, and he quit. Kendrick, I mean. Quit? Are you deaf? Dory Maud rings the bells right by my ear. She calls out to someone just behind me. November bells! Best price on the island! Sometimes she reminds me a lot of her sister Elizabeth,
and not in a favourable way.
Then she says to me, "It's all talk, isn't it? They say Kendrick wanted to buy the stallion, and Malvern said no, so he quit."
I think of Sean, folded low over the red stallion, riding bareback at the top of the cliffs. Of the easy way they had with each other when I met him to look at the Ishkamer. I think even of the way Sean looked when he stood on the bloody festival rock and said his name, and then cause, like it was just fact, one after the other. Of the way he said, "The sky and the sand and the sea and Kor," to me. And I feel a bite of unfairness, because in everything but name, it seems to me that Sean Kendrick already owns Kor.
So what are they doing with him? How should I know? I just saw them parading past and Malvern looking like it's his birthday.
Now my sense of injustice is truly ringing. I abruptly change my plans from going to the cliff to watch from above to going down the cliff path to find out what's happening on the beach.
"I'm going down there." "Don't talk to Malvern, son," Dory Maud warns.
I'm already heading away, but I glance back over my shoulder.
"Why not?" "Because he might talk back."
I hurry down the cliff path, past the rest of the tents. As the path descends steeply, the vendors can no longer get their tables to sit evenly, so it grows more quiet. And there, down below, is the red stallion, surrounded by four men. I recognize the square form of Mutt Malvern and the man holding the lead, David Prince, because he used to work Hammond's farm near us. But none of the others. There's a loose circle of people gathered around them as well, watching and laughing and shouting. Mutt shouts something back to them. Kor lifts his head, jerking the arm of the man who holds him, and calls to the sea, high and pure. Mutt laughs.
"Having some problems holding him, Prince?"
"I'll hold him,"
shouts someone from the gathered group, and there's more laughter. I imagine Dove taken from me in this way, and anger churns in my stomach. I know that Sean must be here, somewhere. It takes me a moment to spot him, but by now I know how. Look for the place with no movement, for the person who's just a little part away from the rest. Sure enough, there he is, standing with his back to the cliff, an arm across his stomach, his other elbow resting on it, his knuckles pushed tightly against his lips, but his face is expressionless. There's something terrible about the way he stands there, watching. He's not so much still as frozen. Farther down the beach, Kor keens again, and Mutt loops a scarlet ribbon tied with bells around Kor's pastern, just above his hoof. At the sound of them, the red stallion flinches, as if the bells are physically painful, and I find myself, unexpectedly, blinking away tears. Sean Kendrick turns his face away. There's something so wretched in that, that I can't just leave him there by himself. I elbow my way through the tourists and the locals who are watching this spectacle. My heart thuds in my chest. I think of Sean telling me, "Keep your pony off this beach." It's possible I'm the last person he wants to see. I stand next to him, with my arms crossed. We don't speak. I'm glad that he doesn't look up, because Mutt has put a saddle on Kor, and now they're draping a breastplate with nails and bells sewn into it over Kor's withers. The stallion's skin shivers wherever the iron touches him. After a moment, Sean says in a low voice, still looking at the ground,
"Where's your horse?"
"I worked her last night, after the rain stopped. Where's yours?"
He swallows.
"How can they do this?" I demand. Kor makes a strange, frenzied sound, like half a whinny,
a sound cut off before it began. He stands still, but he jerks his head as if trying to rid himself of a fly.
I reckon, Sean says, in that same low voice, that it's wise of you to ride your own horse, Puck, even if she's just an island pony. Better that your heart's your own.
Mutt Malvin says,
I thought he'd be bigger.
He's climbed onto Cor, though Prince still holds the lead rope. One of the other men stands between Cor and the sea, his arms held out on either side like a fence. Mutt swings his legs and looks at the ground as if he's a child on a pony.
This is Mutt Malvin's gift to me, Sean says, and there's enough bitter in his words for me to taste it with him. This is my fault.
I try to think of what I can say to comfort him. I don't even know if he wants it. I don't know if I'd want to be comforted, if I'm being honest. If I'm being forced to eat soot, I want to know that somewhere else in the world, someone else has to eat soot as well. I want to know that soot tastes terrible. I don't want to be told that soot's good for my digestion. And of course, by soot, I mean beans. Probably it is, I reply. But in 20 minutes, or 30 minutes, or an hour, Mutt Malvern will get bored of this. And then he will be back on that wretched black-and-white creature that he's put on the butcher's board by his name. And I think the piebald's quite enough of a punishment for anyone. Sean looks at me then, his eyes bright, in a way that makes me feel out of sorts. I glare back.
Where did you say your horse was again?
Home. Trained yesterday evening. Why did you say you quit again? He looks away with a rueful snort.
It was a gamble. Like you and your pony.
Horse.
Right.
Sean looks back to Cor.
Why did you say you were racing again?
I hadn't said, of course. It goes against everything in me to confess the true reasons behind my decision. I can imagine it being chatted all over Skarmouth, as easily as Dory Maud told me how Sean Kendrick had quit over Cor. I haven't told Peg Grattan, even though it seems like she is on my side. Nor Dory Maud. And Dory Maud is nearly family. But I hear myself say, we'll lose my parents' house if I don't win. I realize then how foolish it is to say it. Not because I think Sean Kendrick will gossip, but because he'll know now that I hope not only to race, but to make money at it. And that's a terribly fanciful thing to be saying to Sean Kendrick. 4-time winner of the Scorpio races. He is quiet for a long moment, his eyes on Cor and Mutt on his back.
That's a good reason to gamble, he says,
and I feel incredibly warm toward him for saying that, instead of telling me that I'm a fool. I exhale. So is yours.
Do you think so?
He's yours, no matter what the law says. I think Benjamin Malvern's jealous of it. And,
I add,
I think he likes to play games with people. Sean looks at me in that sharp way of his.
I don't think he realizes how it impales people. You know a lot about him.
I know that Benjamin Malvern likes to drink his tea with butter and salt in it, and that his nose is big enough to hide acorns in. I know that he wants to be entertained, but that few things manage it. But I don't know if that means that I know him. Enough, I reply.
I'm not, he says, fond of games.
We both look back to Cor, who has, against everything I would have thought, settled down. He stands perfectly still, looking over the crowd, his ears pricked. Every so often, he quivers, but otherwise, he doesn't move.
Should I see how fast he is?
Mutt says. He turns in the saddle to eye Sean, who doesn't flinch.
David Prince, still holding the lead, has an odd expression as he glances over to us. A bit guilty, a bit apologetic, a bit thrilled.
Ho, Sean Kendrick, Prince says,
as if either we or he has just appeared on the beach.
Any advice?
Don't forget about the sea, Sean says.
Mutt and Prince exchange a laugh at this.
Look how tame he is,
Mutt tells Sean. And surely, Kor's ears are pricked and interested. He sniffs at his saddle and at Mutt's leg, as if surprised only that it's not his usual, as if it's a curious turn of events. The bells on his bridle shrill almost inaudibly with the movement.
None of Sean Kendrick's much-touted brand of witchcraft needed. Does it bother you that he's so faithless?
Sean doesn't reply. Mutt's eyes swipe over me dismissively. I don't think I've ever seen someone take so much pleasure in making someone else miserable. I remember that first night when I saw them both outside the pub. The hatred that lurked in both their expressions. There's nothing hidden about it now. It's an ugly sore. Mutt addresses the crowd. Tourists, most of them.
What do you think? I'm about to take the fastest horse on the island out for a gallop. He's a legend, right? A hero, a national treasure. Who doesn't know his name?
They clap and hoot. Sean is immobile, a piece of the cliffs.
I know it!
I shout then, and my voice is so loud that it surprises me. Mutt's gaze finds me next to Sean. I call.
But what's yours again?
I give him my most horrible smile, the one that I learned from having two brothers. As I watch Mutt's face light up with anger and listen to the murmur of amusement from the onlookers, I remember, too late, Dory Maud's advice.
Where's your pony then?
Mutt snaps back.
Plowing fields!
I'm more embarrassed by the attention than by the insult. Probably, because when I'm done down here, I'll be back in Dory Maud's booth, selling baubles to tourists. It occurs to me that Mutt Malvern doesn't know me well enough to say something to properly hurt me. It's not me that Mutt wants to hurt, anyway. He calls.
I have to say, I'm pleased for you, Kendrick. Is she a better ride than you're used to?
He pretends to caress Kor's rump. I feel my cheeks go hot. Sean's face doesn't change, and I wonder at it. Is it practice? Is it that he's heard all these things too many times for them to prick his skin? Beneath Mutt, Kor moves restlessly. He pushes his nose toward Prince, nuzzling into his chest. Prince scratches his forehead and pushes back.
Steady, old lad, he says.
Prince tilts his head back to face Mutt.
Are you taking him out, then? Before the tide gets up on us?
As he speaks, Kor presses again, more insistently, so that the bells ring again, and Prince pushes back.
Yeah, indeed,
Mutt replies. He wiggles one of the reins to get Kor's attention. Kor still nuzzles and pushes at Prince. I see the shudder of Kor's skin beneath the iron-bound breastplate they've put on him.
Okay now,
Prince says. Kor's muzzle is at his collarbone, like Dove does when I scratch her mane and she's feeling fond. Prince lays his hand flat on Kor's cheek, as Kor's breath woofs against Prince's neck. Sean's feet kick up sand, even as he shouts,
David!
Prince looks up. Quick as a snake, Kor's flat teeth crush into his neck. Mutt Malvern hauls back on the reins. Kor climbs into a rear. The crowd shouts and scatters. The other two men who were with Mutt leap back, uncertain if they should defend themselves or help Mutt. Sean jerks to a stop, face turned from the spraying sand. On the ground, Prince arches his back, his feet scrambling. I can't look away. Cor rears again, and this time, Mutt can't keep his hold. He rolls out of the reach of Cor's hooves and comes up, bloody. Prince's blood, not his. The stallion's eyes are white and rolling as he spins. His gaze is on the surf. Everyone else's gaze is on him and on Sean, but none of them is moving. When Cor circles another time, I dart across the sand to where Prince lies. I can't tell how badly he's hurt. There's too much blood to see his skin. I'm afraid that Cor will trample him, but I don't know if I can move him. The best I can do is stand between him and the hooves and try to press down this horror inside me. Cor turns and cries out again. This time, it's like a choked sob. There's a spiderweb of veins standing out on his shoulder. Cor, Sean says. He doesn't shout it. It doesn't seem loud enough to be heard above the sound of the hoofbeats and the surf, or the sound of Prince's gagging, but the red stallion stills. Sean holds his arms out and approaches slowly. There's blood on Cor's lower jaw. His lips quiver. His ears are flat back against his head.
Hold on,
I whisper to Prince. Up close, he's not as young as I thought. I can see every line carved around his eyes and mouth. I don't know if he can hear me. He holds fistfuls of sand, and his eyes on me are a terrible, terrible thing. I don't want to touch him, but I reach down. When he feels my fingers, he clutches my hand so hard that it hurts. Near Cor, Sean shoulders off his jacket and abandons it on the sand, then tugs his shirt off over his head. Underneath, he's pale and scarred. I've never given much thought to whether broken ribs healed straight before now. Sean speaks to Cor in a low, low voice. Cor shakes, his eyes rolling toward the ocean. Prince's blood is all over me. I've never seen so much blood before. This is how my parents died. I tell myself not to imagine it, but it doesn't matter. I can't picture it. There's just no way to make my mind accept the possibility of it, and I'm sorry that I can't. Because as terrible as imagining that might be, it has to be better than living in this current reality, with Prince's shaking hand gripping mine. Sean slowly approaches Cor, speaking in the same low voice all the way. He's 3 steps away. 2. 1. Cor lifts his head, pulling back, his teeth bared and bloody. He's shaking as much as Prince. Sean balls up his shirt and then presses it to Cor's muzzle. He waits a long moment until Cor smells nothing but Sean Kendrick. And then Sean wipes the blood from Cor's mouth. As the stallion stands, rigid, Sean folds the shirt so that the blood faces the sky, then wraps the fabric over Cor's nostrils and eyes.
Daily,
Sean says. Beside him, Cor's nostrils suck the fabric of his shirt against them, showing the outline of his muzzle through the shirt, and then blow it back out again. One of the men who'd come with Mutt jerks at his name. He looks terrified. Sean's eyes flit away, disappointed by whatever he sees in Daly's face. And then they find me.
Puck.
I don't want to leave Prince as long as he's holding my hand so tightly, but I realize suddenly that somewhere along the way it switched to me holding his hand, and not the other way around. Horrified, I drop his fingers with a start and climb to my feet. Sean gestures to the reins that trail from Cor's bridle.
Hold this. Will you hold this? I need...
the red stallion still